Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Recreational marijuana sales are slated to start in Delaware August 1st with medical dispensaries that purchased conversion licenses. And the state plans to accelerate licensing from there.
Our goal is to have all the cultivators done this month, manufacturers along with those, and start rolling into retailers in August. I think from there, the ball really goes into the court of the businesses.
State Marijuana Commissioner Josh Sanderlin joins us to lay out what you need to know about the legal cannabis rollout. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Arts Playlist previews Delaware Shakespeare's annual Summer Festival. And we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. After over 2 years of turbulent efforts to launch Delaware's recreational marijuana market, the first state may finally see some legal cannabis products on the shelves starting next month. The Office of the Marijuana Commissioner announced last week that the state's 13 medical dispensaries that purchased conversion licenses may begin selling recreationally on August 1st. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich spoke this week with Marijuana Commissioner Josh Sanderlin, delving into the competitive advantages for these medical dispensaries, how close other retailers are to coming online, and the future of unregulated hemp-derived products in Delaware.
So the Office of the Marijuana Commissioner recently announced that all medical marijuana conversion licenses may begin recreational sales on August 1st. Talk to me about how your office reached this date and the preparation it took to get to this moment.
I think it took a pretty decent bit of preparation. We didn't want to launch until we were sure that we could start issuing other new licenses. Since, you know, I took office, we've already done, I think we did almost 20 so far. I plan to do another 20 this week. We're hoping in the next 2 months to have all the conditional licenses that are available to be issued. So that way, you know, as folks join and get their documents in and their sites converted, they can just roll right into the adult use and there's not going to be a lag, because many times those lags can hurt businesses. But we also wanted to, you know, work with our existing medical companies who have, you know, been the foundation of our industry thus far, who are ready to operate and ensure that, you know, Delawareans can start accessing cannabis as soon as possible. So, you know, we talked to everybody that's currently operating and asked, you know, if they would be able to do a 30-day turnaround. Everybody said they could. And so, you know, given that information and the governor's desire to get this program going, we went ahead and made the announcement and looking forward to getting everything rolling August 1st.
Yeah, so you just touched on this a little bit about other licenses that you're still working on getting out or some that you have, but part of the language within the bill that legalized conversion licenses, House Bill 408, it outlines that when a conversion retail facility may commence operations, that one of the considerations that must be taken into account is that the commissioner must factor in the number of social equity and micro business retail marijuana stores that are available to open. So can you talk a little bit about this provision and if these considerations were made prior to announcing conversion licenses would open? So essentially this kind of idea about keeping the competition fair within the market.
Right. So for us, you know, it's a fine line to walk and I understand the reasons behind the provision. And so with delay of the FBI background check issue, delay of me coming in the office, we didn't want to continue to hold up the program. And one of the issues we're facing is if, you know, it's chicken and egg in some instances, as long as we maintain medical and we're not switching to adult use, it's very difficult for social equity companies, especially micro business companies, to get investments, to get the ability to start getting capital to operate in a besides the fact of our grant programs and the things we're doing at OMC. So it's really important. It's also important to show other stakeholders, especially local government officials, that the full adult use industry does not come with a lot of the proclaimed harms to society. You know, a lot of times it's showing that once we're operational, in fact, the sky does not fall, that, you know, this creates a tax base, this does promote economic development and hiring, because, you know, a lot of these new companies are also facing the issue of where do I put my business, you know, so, trying to lead by example, I think, is important. And as I said, while we are opening this conversion, we are also opening it to anybody who can get through the process. And now this allows me to really focus all of my attention on getting those folks through the process. A lot of the issues right now are, we don't have the documents that we've requested in some instances. But I, working with Date and my office at OMC, all my staff, we are, we should be through all of the cultivation licenses and manufacturing licenses by the end of the month. Next week, they will start the background. I will start looking at retail locations as well, both social equity and non-social equity. And in point of fact, we actually have a few of these new licensees who will be coming online in the next 2 months. They're not retailers, which a lot of folks point to retailers, but the truth is, if we open a bunch of retailers without manufacturing and cultivation, we see prices go up. We see these guys with empty shelves. So we've been heavily focused on getting the cultivators up. We actually had one go active just last week.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, along those same lines, one of the key parts of the conversion license program is that it generated around $4 million in funding to support social equity applicant startup grants. So, can you tell me more about where social equity license recipients are at with receiving these grants, kind of how they plan to be distributed, and then how close they are to launching?
We are very close to launching the program. We have, the intent right now is to take a two-phased approach. There had been a lot of back and forth about how this program would be established. A lot of discretion was left to OMC to develop the program. And so the way we're looking at the program now is it will be a benchmark-based program. The very first benchmark being if you can get your conditional license. It frees up some of the grant money, which will be provided so that in turn the licensee can begin to start laying the groundwork for site control. And there will be about, depending on the license type, because each license type has different capital requirements, there will be different benchmarks at which point they can get it, get disbursements. In addition to that, after site control, what we want to do is provide the ability for especially more capital intensive projects to request, a more of a bulk release for specific capital requirements. For instance, a lab who needs extra capital to secure their equipment. We don't want them to have to wait around and hit benchmarks when they need to get their equipment in. So once they have site control, it allows them to apply to do a more of a bulk release of the funds that are available to them specifically to purchase large capital investment products.
And then, can you just give our audience a little bit of a rundown of how many dispensaries will become operational on August 1st and where they're located throughout the state?
The easiest way to find out is to go to our website. We have a full list of everybody. We're expecting around a dozen. There'll be 13, I believe, total, which will have the ability to convert. Just because we tell them August 1st doesn't mean they have to on August 1st. We've made that clear. We're just giving them the ability to. So I can't really say for certain how many. And that list will be obviously modified as we add new stores and new locations for folks to go to.
Great. And so there's other language within House Bill 408 that says if a medical dispensary is located in a jurisdiction that opted to ban marijuana business, that the medical dispensary could request an open license in a new location. Is this an option that any of the compassion centers had to use in order to operate lawfully in Delaware? Kind of like how is that shaken out, considering there was a lot of tension over municipalities and some county zoning restrictions, et cetera? How have you seen that come to fruition with these compassion centers that are looking to convert?
It's a fluid process right now. Like I said, I'm not exactly sure how many are going to convert on August 1st. There still may be some stores that reach out and ask for the move. Right now, having just announced the conversion, the stores have not reached out and said, "Hey, can we get the open license in our location?" But I don't think that means they won't necessarily, because there is a lot of tension between local officials and these businesses. And again, that's part of the reason why I wanted to go ahead and launch this program to make sure that we can, show folks that it's not going to bring the sky down.
And there's also Senate Bill 75, which has not yet been signed by the governor. There's been a lot of discourse around the General Assembly overriding local control this legislative session. And so this was kind of a hot topic. I know we talked about in our last interview about how these businesses need a viable place to operate, right? Which is kind of what we were just discussing. So this bill would limit the zoning requirements and restrictions that a county can place on a marijuana business. So have you heard any updates from Governor Matt Meyer's administration about his intention to sign that legislation?
Not yet. I know it's under review by his administration. You know, as soon as I hear, you know, I'll probably be able to let everybody know, but I'm sure it'll come out of his office before it comes out of my office.
Okay, and also in relation to the General Assembly, there was the death of a bill you could say that would have regulated hemp-derived products and THC-infused beverages. I know we also discussed that a little bit in our last interview. So, does your office have any plans to tackle this in the near future? It seems like legislators are still interested in bringing a bill to the table, but unless it's a special session, that's, going to be at least 6 months from now. So, just kind of curious about your take on leaving this part of the industry unregulated, or maybe you think that bringing the legal market online will help that. Where do you stand on all that?
It's a complicated issue, obviously, because, you know, as with much of cannabis, it has a federal state interplay. It's just the opposite direction, which is very strange to me, having been in cannabis for so long. It does remain a priority to my office, to me personally. You know, I do think we'll see how opening these new stores helps, you know, the conversion helps. My issue is there's a proliferation of these companies now, and you know, I think they're more likely to have an impact on the regulated market than the regulated market is on them. You know, when you can offer unregulated products at cheaper prices, significantly cheaper prices, because you don't have to, you know, spend all the money to ensure public safety with testing, accountability, and whatnot. So it remains a strong priority in my office, and you know, I plan to use the next 6 months to work with members of legislature like Heffernan to strengthen the bill, to really focus, you know, how we can, you know, not hurt businesses, but also ensure that we're protecting the public and we are keeping track of what's coming into the state and what's going into our bodies and what's going into our customers.
And I mean, wrapping up here, really, you mentioned this right at the beginning, but I guess just to kind of give a more concrete sort of what are our next steps as far as the rest of the licenses, sounds like you guys are really working on getting those out. You mentioned 20 more, maybe sounds like next week. So give me a little bit more of a timeline again on where you guys are kind of at and what consumers should be looking forward to in the future.
From our administrative perspective, we are looking to have the conditional licenses issued to the extent we have documents from everybody, have them all issued by the end of summer, if not sooner. Our goal is to have all the cultivators done this month, manufacturers along with those, and start rolling into retailers in August. I think, you know, from there, the ball really goes into the court of the businesses. And it's about finding locations, you know, getting partners, and really, you know, tackling all the obstacles you tackle when you start a new business. except you're starting a new business in an extremely regulated environment. And, you know, my goal is to really work with companies, existing and potentially new, to make sure that, you know, my office, while regulating, ensuring public safety, is also, a partner in the process of getting open and supporting an industry, because, you know, while it's our job to keep it safe, it's also our job to keep it healthy, you know, and ensure that, you know, while we are overseeing everything that's coming out of them and going to consumers, that they are able to actually, you know, open a business and understand the interplay and have questions answered as opposed to operating in a vacuum. And I think a lot of the times it's providing information that is the key to getting these businesses going and started appropriately. So yes, over the next few months, that's what we're looking at as from that perspective. You know, we have legislative goals like we just talked about to discuss with members coming back in January. And ultimately, for the consumer, you know, competition is key. You know, providing, you know, more products on the marketplace, providing more outlets to procure products is important to driving down the price, increasing the quality, and increasing the access for the individual. I mean, those are really our main goals moving forward. And then, you know, to help, you know, make sure that our regulations are, you know, at the forefront of cannabis regulations in the country as well.
Thanks to Delaware Marijuana Commissioner Josh Sanderlin and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us, Art's Playlist is next, with a preview of Delaware Shakespeare's annual summer festival. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware Shakespeare takes the stage at Newcastle County's Rockwood Park for its annual series of summer shows starting July 18th, with a preview show the night before. The show is Twelfth Night, O Lo Que Quieras, a musical bilingual reimagining of the Shakespeare classic. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny sits down with Delaware Shakespeare's producing artistic director, Mariah Gant, to learn more about the show.
For the summer set of performances, you're kind of stepping away from traditional Shakespeare and doing kind of a Shakespeare plus. Tell me about the show.
We're doing Twelfth Night, O Lo Que Quieras. This is a bilingual musical adaptation of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Some people have deemed Twelfth Night Shakespeare's, have deemed it like the perfect comedy because it consists of hijinks, there's mistaken identity, there's confusions of love. And so it has kind of everything. And we've taken that and exploded it even more by adding music and by also making it partially in Spanish. And I think some people hear that and they think, well, will it be harder for me to understand the story? But quite the opposite. You know, something that we always say at Del Shakes in the beginning of our performances is, if you know Shakespeare well or if you don't know Shakespeare well, what we encourage you to do is let the words wash over you like music. So don't feel like you have to pick apart every single word that you're hearing, but instead absorb it all and watch and feel as it's occurring. And I think the Spanish language and the music does that incredibly well for this show. It really allows people to have multiple ways that they can tap into the story, ways that they can find their specific point of entry. And it makes it just that much more accessible for a wider group of people.
Tell me a little bit about the plot, and also in terms of plot points, how close does it hew to Twelfth Night?
I would say if you are a Shakespeare fanatic and you come and you watch this and you're expecting the exact same plot to plot to plot to plot, you maybe won't get that. But there's definitely some big alignments that you'll see, but the ways in which that they're explored are a little bit different. So the major plot point of the twins who arrive on this new land, who arrive in Illyria, that still exists, and they're separated trying to find each other. That is still the major through line. What's kind of shifted now is that the twins, Violeta and Sebastian in our production, they are arriving from Venezuela into Illyria. And Illyria is still this kind of questionable place on exactly where in the map it is, but that's how it is in Shakespeare's world. And when they both arrive, they arrive on the night of a major political election. And so Orsino and Olivia, who in Shakespeare's play are not political figures, but in this play they are. And Orsino rises to power, Olivia falls from power. And now the question is just how will they use their powers in order to help people or to maybe perhaps keep people further apart? Will they learn from their mistakes? And what is Violeta's work going between the two of them, trying to get them to see and understand the ways in which they can be more helpful as people?
We talked a little bit about the plot, but what does this show mean at this moment in American history?
Absolutely. The story is really about the migrant experience. It really is about providing a voice for people who maybe otherwise they're being silenced historically, but even more so right now, we can see the ways in which they're being silenced and pushed out. And we're working really hard to have a conversation about how all people are people and we can all work together to uplift one another. I think particularly right now, you know, the story was deeply meaning when we did it in performances in 2022, but in 2025, it has an even more crucial moment to be seeing these twins coming from Venezuela to a place where they're seeking to be received and find community and find love. But instead they're being pulled apart and pushed out. And I think many of us can look around and see the world as it is today and see the ways in which that is popping up incredibly strongly for us. And so these stories need to be told. These voices need to be heard. And it feels so important to be making that space. People might think, well, why here in Delaware? But these stories are happening everywhere. And it's important to be uplifting them, whatever size stage we have, whatever size microphone you have. It feels really important to be making the space and making it heard.
One of the things that I always enjoy talking to you about with Del Shakes is the effort that you put into accessibility. You're doing some special performances through this run. Can you tell me, I know there's a family night. Talk a little bit about some of the special nights coming up.
Absolutely. So we have family nights, which will be every Sunday. So those performances start at 6 o'clock. I think those are a great way to get the family all out there together. Kids under 12 get in for free with the purchase of an adult ticket. And then we also have some, we'll have a kids tent. So if the kids are watching the show and they maybe want to like get up and kind of run around, they can do that. They can go over to the tent and do some crafts as well. That second Sunday of performances, we're having a relaxed performance. And so this performance is for folks who maybe have other access needs, maybe have ADHD, autism, somewhere on the spectrum, any other thing like that makes people who have different kind of sensory needs and need a different connection into the show. We'll be turning the volume down on the music, so people who have sensory needs with sound specifically, it's a little easier for them. And then since the show starts at 6 that day, the lights won't be nearly as strong as they usually are. We'll also have a sensory walkthrough of the set before the show, which I'm really excited about, to give people, if they get there early, they can get kind of a tactile, hands-on experience. We also have Wednesdays are our Pay What You Will performances. So we have ticket prices starting as low as $5 on that day, really trying to make it accessible for folks no matter what your income point is, that you can be able to make it out to a performance. Also, that second Wednesday, we are doing a BiLAM Plus or People of Color, and then an LGBTQIA Plus night. So we'll have another group there that'll be tabling, talking about their organization, which is for expansive communities within particularly the Latinx community and the queer community in Delaware.
Where can people go to find show dates and show times and ticket information?
Absolutely. You can visit our website, delshakes.org. You can also catch us on Instagram at delshakes. We're also on Facebook at /delshakes. Performances run July 17th through August 3rd. And we're really excited to be sharing with everybody out at Rockwood Park this summer.
Thanks to Delaware Shakespeare's producing artistic director, Mariah Gant, and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. You can hear an extended version of this interview online at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environment and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. On this episode, we focus on Indigenous dance and its connections to the environment, as well as its role in connecting Delawareans to the land and history of Indigenous people in the First State. To help us make and understand these connections is Herman Jackson of the Nanticoke Tribe in Delaware, where he serves as spiritual advisor. Jackson has performed tribal dances throughout the state and around the country since 2012. So let's start with a little history lesson about Indigenous tribal dance. You know, what are its roots? What was the original purpose?
Now, from what I've learned, before contact, before the Europeans come over, everything was prayer dances. They always told a story back to the Creator to thank Him. So if they were on a hunt, some dances reflect being on a hunt and killing your game, or even if you chase away warriors that were encroaching upon you, you would give thanks. So it was always to give thanks back to the Creator for what He had given us.
And so that would be, you know, health, the well-being of the environment around you,
the
animals around you, crops. Yeah. So basically, it was a large way of like thanking the Creator for kind of the abundance around them. Or I guess if there was an abundance at the time, hoping for that.
Yeah, the so-called rain dance. Mm-hmm. There actually was a dance to ask for rain, from what I was told way back. But it was not rain specific, just in general. And our grass dance goes back to where the Plains Indians, when they moved camp, them dancers would go out and step on the grass to flatten it out so they have their encampment. And then when they moved to the next one, the grass could spring back up and continue on living.
So in a lot of ways, it was a way to kind of connect not only with the Creator but with the environment around
you. To the environment, yes.
It's fascinating. So tell me a little bit about how it developed over time. How did it go from what we've just talked about as kind of these prayers to more of what we see today? How do we get from point A to point B?
The best I'd come up with was back during the 1880s, 1890s, the Wild West shows come into effect. Sitting Bull and all of them, they reenacted. And that's where they started performing more. And like it stated, if I say a prayer dance, nobody will come and see it. If I call it a war dance, they'll pay money to come and see it. And it's the same dance. So it tells the same story. They just changed the name to draw in people. They done it for revenue.
Yeah, so in a lot of ways it was about, as you mentioned, the revenue. It was also about kind of connecting with communities and trying to kind of get people to be involved with any given tribe.
Yes, and one thing about it, when back in the Wild West shows, the Native Americans went bare-chested. They didn't wear a lot of clothes and all. And they say the men and women, the Europeans, didn't like to see them out there, so they made them start wearing shirts. At one time, the one-piece long underwear was part of regalia. They would have to wear that and aprons over it just so they were covered up.
So that was it did become more – that added to the performance, right? It gave people a reason to come in, not just to see the dance, but to see the regalia, the garb that they were wearing.
Because they got paid by the amount of people they drew in. Mm-hmm. So the flashier they dressed and moved, the more money they made. So that's why a lot of dances went from contemporary – or traditional to more contemporary dance.
Did they when they started adding the garb in and adding the regalia in, was there an effort to connect that to the dance, to the message, use it as symbolism for anything? I guess was there a purpose behind the garb besides just saying, hey, we're going to dress things up a little bit?
Not back then per se, from what I understand, but you got to remember at one point about 1883-84, the ghost dance come out. Mm-hmm. That's when they thought they could bring the spirits back and the indigenous people could take back our land. Mm-hmm. But our government was scared of it. They didn't understand it. So they forbidden any gathering. We couldn't wear feathers, none of regalia. They stripped us of all of that. We could not have religious freedom. Mm-hmm. We couldn't go to a ceremony. We couldn't do ceremonies. They stripped that out, and that went clear up. And if you believe it or not, to 1978. Mm-hmm. Actually, Jimmy Carter just passed. He was the president that signed the Religious Freedom Act. Mm-hmm. So that part of history ain't that old, because we remember Jimmy Carter.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, as we move into the present day, how much has it changed from that point in time until today, you know, in terms of purpose, the dances themselves, the regalia that goes with them? What is like some of the meaning behind the things that are done today now?
Well, today, you got to remember, we got basically two different powwows.
Mm-hmm.
One is traditional,
yep,
and one is competition. Competition, you compete for payout, for money. And Midwest, all them big powwows, I mean, first place would be a couple thousand dollars. Mm. So that powwow kind of taken over because you get more and better dancers, and more dancers, more drums, the more spectators you draw.
Mm-hmm.
Where ours, which is in Millsboro,
yep,
it is actually a traditional. All we do is offer them lunch. So they show up on their own pocket money, because it's expensive going to different powwows depending on where you live. So we all try to offer them a great lunch. But you talk to them and they enjoy it because it's not competition. They say they're right there. They can, like, reunite with Mother Nature, with our ancestors, because they're not competing or nothing. They're just out dancing and enjoy it.
So the tone is different.
Yeah, oh, completely. Okay. Competition powwows, they don't even want to talk to you. I mean, it's a lot of people don't even like going because they don't socialize as much as a traditional powwow. Traditional powwow, you can sit down beside someone, they'll share their lunch with you or whatever and talk to you and give you tips of what you've done wrong or right.
So is there a sense that the traditional powwow harkens back more to the original purpose and meaning of the dances and the connecting with the creator, connecting with the land, connecting with the environment?
Oh, completely. Because, like I say, you're there only you want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you get out of it. It's the satisfaction of going in that sacred circle and dancing for the creator or your relatives around you.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about when you perform, you know, examples of these dances and what the meaning you're trying to convey, the stories you're trying to convey. Can you give me an example of, okay, if you're going to perform somewhere, what is that dance like and what are you trying to do?
Well, my dance is a traditional Southern straight dance.
Mm-hmm.
Each dance has its own style, its own regalia.
Mm-hmm.
I wear a trailer. We all wear ribbon shirts, leggings, aprons, but then we change up. Traditional Northern wears a feather bustle, a big round circle of feathers on their back, and their dance is way different. The drum beat is different. When you go to a powwow, if you listen real close, you know there's a Southern drum and a Northern drum. Two completely different drums singing everything. But like I say, a Southern style dance is you're going out and you're telling the story of a hunt or a fight, a battle you were in, and you're showing the creator what you've done and thanking him. That part has not changed. Mm. The story's still there. Northern, it still tells a story. The story's still there. Then you get into other dances like fancy dance. Some of them ain't been around for, 50 years or mm-hmm. so, not old at all.
Relatively new.
Yeah, the contemporary dance style and in their own right they're just as pretty. The spectators love the fancy dance with all the feathers and mm-hmm. movement and everything.
When you're out performing, how much of it is about yourself and those who you're dancing with, and how much is it about making sure you're engaging with the spectators that are on hand?
It all depends what powwow I'm at.
Okay.
If I'm at my powwow, at ours,
mm-hmm.
they are my guest. So I think it's my job to go out and talk to them, to make them feel comfortable. And I will cross over the rope and just go out and talk to the public, whoever's standing around, little kids, grown-ups, take pictures and all. And I think that is part of my job because they are my guests.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to other powwows, then I'm a guest there. So I get to go out and dance. And even there, I will leave the circle and go talk to the spectators to see how they're doing, if they're enjoying it, if they want to know something about a dance or all,
mm-hmm.
if I can tell them I'm more than happy to explain things to them. And I have more fun doing that than dancing because I'm old. My bones don't take it as much.
Well, what kind of reactions do you get? What kind of questions do you get when you're out engaging people at a powwow?
Oh, back to regalia. A lot of them say, are you real Indian? Mm-hmm. That's a big question.
But that's an interesting question, right? Because that kind of gets to the heart of trying to make people aware of indigenous communities around them, because it seems odd that someone would not know if you're a real Indian or not, right? I mean, that's kind of like an odd question if you take a step back and think about it.
Well, you look at TV. That's what killed us. Mm-hmm. They always got the long braids and all Indians did not wear long braids. All Indians did not live in teepees. Mm-hmm. All Indians did not ride horses. So the stereotype that TV showed, and by the way, the earlier black and white TV shows, most of them Indians were Italian actors. They wouldn't even use Native Americans to play Native Americans. But then you get to real life. I got a brother, he got blue eyes. I got green eyes. So we're all over the rainbow. Mm-hmm. That's just in a family. Mm-hmm. So people, it's hard to tell if you're real Indian because their concept of a real Indian come from TV.
And I was going to say, I guess that's part of what your hope is with these type of events and going beyond the powwows to other events and things like that is to let people know that this community still exists and kind of let them know the history of why perhaps they don't know about the Nanticoke here in Delaware or the Lenape, because they, in some ways they were kind of pushed away and pushed aside and hidden.
Yeah. Well, like I say, way back it was assimilate or eradicate. Mm-hmm. Two choices. Which one would you choose?
Right.
So they hid. They became what people saw them as. So if they could pass for white, they were white. If they passed for black, they were black. That word mulatto is a made-up word, and I don't like using it. Mm-hmm. The same as saying Moor up here. Because the Lenape, from what I understand, Moor was actually a Spanish group of people way back. Mm-hmm. And there was a farm up here, and the owners were Moor. Mm-hmm. And most of them worked on there like a plantation.
Sure.
And that's where the term come from what I understand. And I never did like it, but that's a cross they have to bear.
Right.
And explain to people that, you know, mulatto, Moor are just made up names.
Right.
And they really have no significance to us.
So, you know, you talked about some of the other places that you perform outside of the powwows. Talk a little bit about that and what you hope to do at those performances, whether let's start with maybe like younger kids, schools and things like that. What is your goal when you go to perform there, and kind of what kind of reaction do you get from younger folk?
Well, I take a lot of artifacts, per se, furs and all, and I lay them out and pass them out, let them touch it, so they get to feel what a coyote would feel like. Mm-hmm. Our skunk, we always have a lot of fun with the skunk. Then there's beaver, muskrat, possum, all of these furs and different things that we let them touch and explain to them how they were used back in the day. That they were made for clothes, blankets. We got gourds that we grew for make bowls with, utensils, how we use bone for tools. Man, you name it, all of it. Basket.
Yeah, I was going to say, a real chance for them to understand how indigenous communities really lived off the land. And so all these things that you see around you, that was part of their tools, their clothing, and all those type of things that I'm sure, like for students, for younger children, in our world, say you don't see, like you see computers and you see utensils and stuff. They're made out of metals, and this is like a whole different thing that for them.
Yeah, and like third, fourth, fifth graders, you talk about the leather wearing it and all how the skin, and they think it's really bad. You know, say ooh, and then you ask them if they own a leather coat, and they say yeah, leather sneakers.
Same thing.
What do you think that is? I said, it's even worse because it's probably pig or cow.
Right.
or horse.
Not as high quality.
Yeah. So they can put it together, but they still learn that we were here. This year, the different schools we go to, third grade, mm-hmm. they had a just recent studied Native American. And some schools, I was surprised how much they did know. You know, they knew what a wigwam or wickiup was. Mm-hmm. They knew that the East Coast didn't live in teepees. Mm-hmm. And I give credit to the teachers and all
that. Is that
for
encouraging that yes. younger folk really have a better understanding than maybe people our age even have?
Yeah. But then you talk to the teachers and they say they're limited to what they can teach,
right.
Who teaches it and all, which is, you know, we always think without Native American history, there is no United States history.
Right.
But they kind of forget the one and teach the other.
Right.
But, yeah, I always feel good when they ask good questions and I know they'd learned something. And I always try to thank the teachers for that.
I want to go back to talking about the annual powwow and just ask you how important that event is to the Nanticoke in terms of connecting to its own history and its own community, as well as connecting and bringing other people in to learn about the Nanticoke.
Well, number one is our annual powwow is we do that to have an income because mm-hmm. we support a center and a museum. We got the only true Native American museum in the state. So we need the revenue to keep all of that going. So our powwow is our fundraiser mm-hmm. for those two items. Plus we get grants and all.
Right,
I got to put that out there too. The state does kick in a little teeny, teeny bit.
Right.
But they do something. But it does give us a chance to reach out to the community to let them know we are still here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I talked to several people who say they ride by the museum every day, never stop in. And you say, why?
I was going to say, having the center and the museum certainly is an important piece of the puzzle. How important is that, and how much more are you hopeful you can do with that to, again, extend your reach and connect with more people, engage more people?
Oh, we try. We have Native American Day and Heritage Day at the museum. That's one at the beginning of the year, May, I think, and then another one in November. And there are two we put on right there at the museum. And we sell food and all, and it's open to, we invite the public. We want the mm-hmm. public to come in, and they get a chance to go to the museum and everything.
Tell us about what's in the museum.
Oh, we got artifacts, a lot of arrowheads, mm-hmm. all different things that the community, there's a section where the Nanticoke had made eel pots, fishing nets, all different beadwork they've done, pine needle baskets. Oh, a little bit of everything, and it's all just for Nanticoke, which would be local.
Right.
And then we got a lot of other stuff from different tribes that were donated. It's hard to say.
Okay, but it's a good. It sounds like it's a good snapshot of what the Nanticoke was about, is about, and its connections to kind of the world around it, the environment
yeah.
around it.
Well, you take an arrowhead. People mm-hmm. think it's just a piece of stone,
mm-hmm.
but in the beginning. That stone probably come out of Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
because they have the flint.
Right.
Down on the beach, we don't have flint. We have very little you can make arrowheads with. So that stone made its way from Pennsylvania all the way down to, say, Laurel, Vienna, and was traded for clams, shell food,
right?
You know, or something.
Right.
And then they take that stone and then they nap it, shape it, and make that arrowhead. And then that arrowhead might travel down Pocomoke or over Assateg Island or so, where he has to travel to hunt and shoot his game. And usually you try to get your arrowhead back, but not always.
Right.
So you think of the distance that one piece of stone traveled and what it went through.
And all the things that are involved in it, because you talk about you know, the hunting the game, but also like the trading of the clams and the other. So it's, you know, so the Nanticoke had that resource by the bay and the sea.
Yeah.
And they were able to use that to connect with the stone and the flint they needed for the arrowhead, which then led them to be able to get the game that they needed. So it's interesting how it's also interconnected.
Yeah. It ain't just an arrowhead. Right. It's a story with every little stone in there. If you think about it.
It is incredibly fascinating. You know, as we start to wind down a little bit, how effective do you feel dance, other parts of tribal tradition, like the museum, the artifacts, are in educating and giving people a better understanding and engaging them and helping them really learn about, as you said, this community that's always kind of been there in their backyard?
Well, we know we can't depend on schools to teach about us.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, if we want to be recognized and all, we have to go out and present ourselves. And like I say, we go to schools from one end of the state clear to the other. We've been in New Jersey to a school.
Mm-hmm.
We were invited over there. Me and my partner, Officer Mike Harmon, we go, you know, and do these performances and we might pick up somebody to help us out, but usually it's us too. And we made trips out to Lebanon, Missouri. We took dancers out to Lebanon, Missouri, because he knew, actually, Chief of Police of Dover. Hmm. Moved down to Texas, became a Texas Ranger. But anyway, they do chuck wagon cooking for wagons for warriors, for wounded vets and all. They raise money. And they said they didn't have no Indians. It was always cowboys. So Mike got the big idea that we're going to go out there and represent. And we done made six trips out there.
And provide that part of the story.
Yeah, for way out there. And they have their own, because they ain't but 2 hours from Oklahoma.
Right, right.
And we all know Oklahoma is where all the majority of the indigenous people ended up. But we could do that. Old schools in Wilmington and just all over. And you watch them when they go out, and this little girl might come up and give you a hug, or this little boy come up and give you a hug on the way out, and you know you've done something then.
As you look ahead, are you hopeful that the identities of tribes like the Nanticoke are kind of being better remembered and better understood and are being part of, as you mentioned, the tapestry of the history, where maybe they hadn't been for many, many years.
Yeah, because nowadays I know the Pocomoke, they do similar to same things. They don't have dancers, but they demonstrate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to them and I learn a lot just from them. We were at Mattapani in down Maryland, and they have people that do show artifacts and like an outreach to the way they lived, not just the dancing, not just the power, but the way they lived and all. And to me, that's more important. The dancing gets them there, but then we teach them about our tribal history and all.
I was going to say, as you look ahead, is there anything you'd like to see more of, or you would like in a perfect world to help people connect better and know more of the history better?
Yeah, I would like to see more of our tribal people step up and start doing more. Because, like I say, it ain't but two of us. And I got to admit, we waited till after retirement.
Right.
Because we go all middle of the day. Sometimes we do two schools in one day. And it's time consuming.
Absolutely.
Because you got to factor in the ride to get there and the only a 20-minute performance. But you got 4 hours tied up in that 20 minutes. Mm. So to have more people helping out would be great.
Extend your reach.
Yeah. And even I know Nanticoke Lenni Lelape out of Bridgeton, New Jersey. They do some of the same things because they're like sister tribes.
Sure.
And Dover, we get help from them. We come up Dover. We've even done Del Tech Early Learning.
Sure, yeah.
It's somewhere up here.
Yep.
We were up here this year, done a program there for little kids and the bigger kids and the adults. So, yeah, if we can just keep on doing it. Let me say, you might, if you, anybody in Dover area knows Bruce Morris, Bruce Little Drum Morris. He started doing this, oh, like 40 years ago. He would go out to schools, Boy Scouts, but he started it way back before anybody else even thought about it. Unfortunately, he passed this year, but just to mention him for what he had started, because I do it, because he did it, and I helped him for a while, then, you know, I figure I owe it to him to continue.
And the hope is the tradition will continue.
Yeah,
beyond.
That somebody behind me is coming up.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with Herman Jackson of the Nanticoke Tribe in Delaware. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that brings us to the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities, and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petchwich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.